Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, December 6, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing regulatory federalism. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Paul Watkins, who is the Civil Litigation Division Chief in the Office of the Arizona Attorney General. After remarks from Paul, we will move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Paul. The floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wes, for the opportunity to speak on this teleforum. And now, many speakers engage the audience by opening with a joke. I'm a government regulator, so I'll try to engage you all with a disclaimer. These are my views and don't necessarily represent those of the state of Arizona or the Attorney General. I would recommend to you an op-ed by my boss, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, on Arizona's fintech sandbox, which appeared in the American Banker. Today, I'd like to talk about the benefits of regulatory federalism for emerging technologies such as fintech. So let me define the term regulatory federalism. So when I use the term regulatory federalism, I mean a system where states create innovative regulatory structures and federal agencies use their exemptive rulemaking authority to allow those structures to flourish without undue interference. There are many potential benefits to regulatory federalism. One is reducing regulatory barriers to entry provides consumers new and innovative products. A large part of my job is consumer protection, so this is an issue near and dear to my heart. It's tempting for me as a regulator to view my decision of whether something is unfair or deceptive and therefore unlawful as the most important part of a consumer's experience. In fact, I sometimes think that the faith our statutes place in a regulator's good intentions might be the closest thing we have in this country to an establishment of religion. But any regulator with an ounce of humility would have to acknowledge the role innovation has played in improving the consumer experience. If I'm dissatisfied with my bank, I can go online in a matter of minutes, set up an online savings account, or buy a CD from a bank in India. No regulator can claim credit for that development. A second benefit of regulatory federalism for financial technology is that it preserves American economic competitiveness. The U.S. has a fractured and redundant financial regulatory system. It features multiple federal regulators and overlapping state and federal regulatory schemes that place us at a significant disadvantage compared to other countries. Let me try and back that up with a couple of statistics. The U.S. received 54% of the $127 billion in global venture capital investment in 2016, but we received only 33% of the global fintech venture capital investment. And I suspect our regulatory structure has something to do with that disparity. But there's one benefit of regulatory federalism that I'd like to focus on for this call, and that's the potential to help states close the gap in venture capital investment. This talk has two parts. First, I'd like to describe the problem, why the concentration of venture capital investment in a few states is concerning. And second, I'll talk about the solution, how state-level regulatory innovation, specifically fintech sandboxes, can help close this funding gap. Finally, how state-level sandboxes should be facilitated by federal regulatory exemptions, which many agencies, including the CFPB, can grant by rule pursuant to their statutory authority. Now, let's get into the problem here. Venture capital investment is concentrated in five states and has become increasingly concentrated as time has gone on. There's a 2000 PricewaterhouseCoopers PwC survey where they note that 71% of U.S. venture capital dollars were invested in five states: California, Colorado, Massachusetts, New York, and Texas. That's in 71% in the year 2000. Now, fast forward to 2016, a time period where many states are trying to increase their share of venture capital investment. PwC found the same five states now accounted for 80% of venture capital dollars, so the concentration is increasing. And when I say five states, I really mean three, because California, New York, and Massachusetts total over 75%. In short, the data supports the anecdotal rule that we often hear that if a startup company is not within 20 minutes, I'm not sure if that's by bike or by car, of the VC firm, then it won't get funded. Well, why does that matter? Who cares whether venture capital is funding is distributed around the country? It matters because 43% of all publicly traded companies since 1979 have been VC-backed, according to research out of Stanford Business School. It matters because venture capital has become more significant since Dodd-Frank. There's a number of studies that have indicated it's more difficult to obtain financing since the Dodd-Frank Act for small businesses. And it matters because new firms are and have been the main driver in job growth for the last few decades. I'll add an additional reason why I think VC funding matters, and that's the strategy of VCs, which is to target existing industries with disruptive technologies such as artificial intelligence and blockchain. These existing industries are scattered throughout the country. Now, if the venture capitalists are successful in disrupting these industries, the new companies will be concentrated in these three states, and that is a big problem for the rest of the country. So what is the solution? I mentioned earlier that many things have been tried over the past decade. States and communities have incubators, accelerators, networking, mentoring programs, and these are undoubtedly important, but it's also clear that they are not closing the gap. Some folks have said the solution is to increase investment in universities, that you need a Stanford like Silicon Valley has or an MIT like Boston has. Apart from the difficulties of matching those institutions, you also sort of have a chicken and egg problem, that those graduates leave to existing capital centers. I'll give you an anecdotal example. Arizona has a very innovative flagship university that's been recognized as one of the top innovative universities in the country, and they run an ad on a bus around town that records this award for innovation. And on that same bus, there's a little tagline that says, "We're one of the best places to get a job in Silicon Valley," demonstrating that just having a high-quality institution may not be enough, because you need the capital and the personnel at the same time. So how do you get these two difficult factors? One answer is to focus on highly regulated industries to create a unique opportunity within a state to innovate. This borrows a concept from foreign jurisdictions called a fintech sandbox. I'd like to describe what a sandbox is. A sandbox is a space for companies to test products in a live environment with actual consumers without the full burden of regulatory requirements. Businesses apply to enter the sandbox and work with regulators to maintain consumer protections for the products that they test. There are certain restrictions in place, limited dollar amounts, number of consumers, exit strategies, contingency plans if the products don't work. And this is helpful to entrepreneurs for three reasons, two of which I'll discuss immediately, and then one I'll save. The first reason is that the sandbox prevents a specific regulation from creating compliance costs that would prevent the testing of a product. Testing is important, of course, because it's the successful tests that are necessary to raise capital to expand the use of the product. But in Arizona, for example, if you have a new idea for a money transmission business, there are a number of compliance costs that you would have with personal information, social security numbers, and so forth that you have to record in order to be licensed as a money transmitter, and those regulatory costs may, in some cases, prevent or delay someone from launching a product. The second benefit of a sandbox is that it sends a signal to the entrepreneurs that they can have a cooperative relationship with a regulator. And I think this factor is actually more important because an entrepreneur doesn't have time to figure out all the regulations that might apply. For example, let's say I want to use a smart contract on some blockchain-based protocol to offer a combination car loan and auto insurance. What is my business? Is it insurance, money transmission, consumer lending, all three, maybe things I haven't thought of? Identifying all the relevant regulations will take a substantial amount of time and resources that would probably be better served developing the product. Now, one reason to believe sandboxes would be effective in the United States is their success and adoption by foreign jurisdictions. Sandboxes are or have been developed in the UK, Singapore, Abu Dhabi, Hong Kong, and Australia. The UK sandbox has produced the most instructive results as it was the first and started in early 2016. So I will discuss some of the results that they have. Now, the UK accepts applicants to enter their sandbox in what are called cohorts, which just means that they're admitting groups of entities together. We chose not to copy this because it's actually a more time-intensive way to admit applicants. But there are some advantages as far as reviewing processes and test results. And since they were the first, I think it made sense for them to do things this way. So they admit applicants in cohorts. They're on their third cohort, and they have some results from their first cohort. They had 69 applicants for the sandbox. 24 were accepted. 18 tested ideas. The range of applicants was varied. They had small startups to large banks like HSBC. Also, the ideas tested ranged widely. There were innovations related to blockchain, insurance, money transferring, consumer-focused financial management, consumer loans, and the results have been very promising. As I said, the FCA recently released a report about these firms. They said after the first year, around 90% of the firms are continuing to a wider market launch. 40% of the products tested received investment during or following the sandbox test. And interestingly, this sandbox coincided with an increase in investments in UK fintech. Those investments more than doubled from $140 million in the first quarter of 2016 to $375 million in the first quarter of 2017. Of course, correlation is not causation. I can't prove that the sandbox caused this doubling of investment, and I'm sure there were other factors. But what's interesting about this stat is that it comes from a report that India prepared called Making India a Global Fintech Hub. So this success is something that other jurisdictions are looking at, saying we need to model that if we want to keep pace in the global economy. Now, in the U.S., most federal regulatory agencies have working groups, but none, to my knowledge, has instituted a sandbox. The CFPB talked about issuing no action letters, but my understanding is that they were very specific and temporary, and I'm not sure that anyone has asked for one. So this makes Arizona's efforts to create a fintech sandbox unique in the United States. And I'll talk a little bit about what this Arizona fintech sandbox would look like. The sandbox would be located within the Arizona Attorney General's office and would have a number of features similar to the UK sandbox. One difference is that applications would be considered on a rolling basis. Applications would be allowed to test one product or service per application. The entity would need to be located in Arizona, or an Arizona entity would need to be created to use the sandbox, which is a relatively simple process in Arizona. We'd require certain background information, criminal convictions, and so forth, as well as using a form that, again, is similar to the FCA form, describing how the idea works, how would this be regulated outside a sandbox, what's the plan for testing. Once in the sandbox, there are a number of restrictions. The consumers must be Arizona residents. There are limits on the number of consumers that can be surfaced. Right now, that limit is 5,000. There are also limits on the amount for particular types of transactions, $2,500 per money transmission to limit risk and also to ensure that these transactions fall under the federal AML limits that would trigger additional reporting requirements. And we've added specific disclosure requirements, including that the product is being offered on a temporary basis. It's important to note that entities in the sandbox would still be subject to the Consumer Fraud Act. It's not a license to commit fraud. The time period we're proposing is 12 months, which is different from the UK. The UK has a six-month time period. Other sandboxes, such as Abu Dhabi, have 2 years. The way the legislation is currently structured is a 12-month period with a six-month extension and then a potential extension of an additional 12 months if necessary to pursue a state or federal license. As I mentioned earlier, this sandbox we believe will be helpful in removing particular state regulatory barriers, also in signaling the possibility of a cooperative relationship with a regulator. But there's a third benefit that I think is very important, and that is a sandbox opens the door to tailored exemptions from federal regulations. So now it's time for me to acknowledge the, I don't know if it's a virtual elephant, but we are in a virtual room. So it's the virtual elephant, and our virtual room is the federal government. A state regulatory sandbox is helpful, but it doesn't prevent a federal agency from swooping in and whacking someone for a technical violation of some federal rule. Before I get into the specifics of federal rules, I think it's worth thinking about the effect of our uniform and comprehensive federal regulatory schemes. Think about what the effect is of those regulations for competition between states. We can assume a burdensome federal regulatory system requires access to capital to navigate. We've already established that if you need significant amounts of capital, you really need to be in three or maybe five states. So the requirement to navigate this financial scheme significantly benefits three states. It means that states are limited in the innovations that they can introduce, and so they're forced to compete among each other by access to capital, access to personnel, which we've already shown the incumbents have significant advantages in. So how big of a deal is federal regulation? How important are these restrictions? Well, let me give you an anecdote. The Dodd-Frank Act allows state attorneys general to enforce many CFPB rules and regulations. So I recently printed out the small dollar lending rule that the CFPB issued. And this happens to be an area that is ripe for innovation. I think I'm not alone among consumer regulators in hoping that there will be innovation in this area, as it's an area that generates enforcement actions and complaints rather routinely. So this particular rule, I'd encourage you all to print it out simply for the experience. It'll take you four 500-page bands of printer paper. It's over 1,700 pages long. I'm not sure it would take a substantial amount of time to understand this rule in order to enforce it. It will take, I'm sure, a substantial amount of time for existing participants to understand it and develop compliance departments. And it would be virtually impossible for any entrepreneur to understand if they wanted to enter this market. So from that anecdote, I'd like to abstract to look big picture at federal regulation. According to the Mercatus Center and the CFR, there are over 1.1 million individual restrictions that mandate or prohibit some activity, which is an increase from 275,000 in the 70s. Now, that's at the federal level, 1.1 million restrictions. At the state level, there are apparently around 64,000 individual restrictions in the Arizona Administrative Code. That's approaching a 20-to-1 ratio. So clearly, dealing with federal regulation is going to be an issue for any state-level sandbox. Fortunately, there's a solution, and it doesn't require federal legislation, which I understand is quite a challenge these days. Many federal agencies have the authority to grant regulatory exemptions. Let's start with the CFPB because they cover so many consumer-facing products, as you would expect from a agency whose first word in the title is consumer. Section 1023 of Dodd-Frank allows the CFPB to exempt, quote, any class of covered persons, service providers, or consumer financial products or services from any provision of this title or from any rule issued under this title as the Bureau determines necessary or appropriate to carry out the purposes and objectives of this title. That's a very broad exemptive authority that includes both the statute and the rules. There are then three factors that the Bureau may consider: total assets of the class of covered persons being exempted, volume of transactions, existing provisions of law applicable to the financial product or service. Looking at that language and those factors, it seems that entities operating within a sandbox would clearly fit within the parameters for exemption. They are, by definition, regulated by the state already. There are limitations posed on the transactions and consumers that they can reach. And ultimately, the criteria for the exemption is the Bureau's determination of what is necessary and appropriate, and that seems inherently discretionary. Incidentally, I have not heard this exemption discussed very much. I have read a number of media articles about the CFPB and the current controversies there and how the drafters were very strategic about ensuring that they could point the agency's trajectory in one direction and that it would be very difficult to change. I think this that may not be true based on this exemptive authority. It seems to me that someone could essentially determine the scope of the agency's jurisdiction depending on their wishes. I don't think it would be hard to draft a rule that, for example, focused enforcement power on institutions that had preemption over state law through national charters or things like that. I'm not speaking for or against such a policy. I'm just pointing out that I'm not sure the agency is as targeted in one direction as some have said. Moving on from the CFPB, the Securities Act and the Securities Exchange Act both give the SEC broad powers to exempt any person or transaction from statutes or rules. The CFTC has a similar broad exemptive authority. And this was interesting to me. I think deposit-taking financial institutions pose the most significant consumer risk, and those institutions, at this point, I don't think we have any mechanism for admitting in Arizona, largely because they're primarily regulated at the federal level. There are other jurisdictions, such as Hong Kong, that have specifically said we want innovation. We want deposit-taking institutions in our sandbox. But the Federal Reserve Act and the Bank Holding Act, they do require the Federal Reserve to consult with the FDIC, but they have pretty broad exemptive authority in those acts as well. So it seems possible to me that someone would have some bandwidth to work with there. In Treasury, which I think is the remaining agency that regulates a lot of this space, primarily through FinCEN and money transmission, most of the FinCEN regulations are in 31 CFR, Chapter 10 or Chapter X, as it's called. 1010.970 allows a secretary to make exceptions or grant exemptions from the requirements of Chapter X, which again is a large percentage of the applicable requirements. So for the relevant financial agencies, I believe there is the statutory or authority to exempt entities in state sandboxes from federal requirements. These exemptions could be narrowly tailored, sandboxes that are 2 years, sandboxes that have transaction or volume requirements, but this would allow states to come up with systems to test different products, to try out innovation, and to benefit not only their states but the country as a whole. And of course, the Representative McHenry, I think, has introduced legislation to create a fintech sandbox, and there are other initiatives at work at the federal level. There's an OCC fintech charter, but that preempts state law, and so some states immediately sued. And then I think other proposals have run in to the basic problems of being adopted in a contentious environment in Washington. As I said before, I think a lot of work here can be done simply through rule. Now, I've focused on the initial funding, the starting of fintech enterprises. There is developing quite a fair amount of literature on launching a national fintech product and how those regulations should be regulated. For those of you who are interested in that next step, I'd recommend a couple articles. One of them is Federalism and Federalization on the Fintech Frontier by Brian Knight. Another is a dual non-banking system, or a non-dual non-banking system, that's one title, by J.W. Verrett. With that, again, Wes, I appreciate the opportunity, and I'd be glad to answer any questions the callers might have.
Wonderful. Let's go ahead and move to audience questions then. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, all you need to do is enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for any audience questions, I just want to start off the session by asking Paul, do you believe that our federal agencies and Congress are disposed themselves to want sandboxes?
Well, I think they are. But I do think there's maybe some competition among the agencies that may not be entirely helpful. So as I sort of referenced, each agency has some sort of working group that is supposed to be dealing with fintech, and these are primarily structured as outreach. They host panels and provide a line of communication, and I think those things are all very useful, but there has not been a coordinated effort among the agencies, since many of these technologies cross over agency jurisdiction. And there also has not been, that I have seen, an effort to relax regulations that may be creating barriers to entry. Now, I don't have a lot of experience interacting with federal agencies. I've read some papers that talk about game theory and how anyone like myself has an incentive to try to protect their turf and make sure that they are a significant regulator. And I can see why that would be the case. I do think that based on the economic message that I hear from the administration, there is a significant emphasis on expanding economic opportunity from the coasts, which saw, I think, an average of three, California, New York, and Massachusetts, I think we're all closer to 3% GDP growth through the recession, to the rest of the country, which most of which was much lower. And I think this type of proposal fits very well within that goal. And so there may be some receptiveness there.
Wonderful. Well, then, speaking on that proposal, what do you think the odds are of this legislation passing in Arizona?
I'm very optimistic. I think the odds are good. We've been reaching out to a number of stakeholders in the government and outside the government, and so far we've received very positive feedback. So we're very optimistic. We think the odds are good, and that this fits with goals that people have been talking about for a while to increase the competitiveness of Arizona.
That's great to hear. It looks like the audience queue is still open. So callers, before we end the call, if you'd like to ask a question, just enter the star key, then the pound key on your telephone. I'd like to inform everyone that our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 7th at 2:30 p.m. Eastern. The call will be on Senator Mike Lee's new book, Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government, and will feature the senator himself. You can see, all the upcoming telephone calls either on our website or through emails that we send to our members, and you can also consult a full roster of recorded podcasts, including this call, that will eventually be uploaded onto our website. While we see if there's any questions before we finish, I want to ask, Paul, are there any remarks that you'd like to give before we finish today?
You know, Wes, I appreciate that invitation. I think I've said about all I have to say here.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank Paul for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.